All right. Can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Cool beans. Well, thank you all for coming out this afternoon. We've been informed that this is the snack bar time. So apologies, but I hope you got to sneak over there. Yes, please come in. Welcome. As we get started. So yes, welcome to From Land Owning to Land Stewarding, Lessons in Discernment from the Faith Land Initiative. We'll be in this room all week, 3:30 to 5. Today, just to kick us all off, it'll be a little bit more on the talking side, just to get us kind of grounded, literally and figuratively, into what exactly we'll be delving into the rest of the week. And then the rest of the week, honestly, y'all will be doing, and whoever else comes after, we'll be doing a lot of the sort of co-creation of the space. So sit tight with us today and then come back the rest of the week, just to let you know. So yeah, we're just going to introduce ourselves and I'll kick it off. My name is Ian West. I go by E. My pronouns are they, them, or just my name E. I'm originally from the D.C. metropolitan area, which is Piscataway land, but came to Seattle almost 5 years ago, and we'll get into some of the different tribes that represent Seattle, but a couple that I'll name here are the Duwamish, the Muckleshoot, and the Puyallup. And then, oh, and the Snoqualmie as well, and I'll let Melly name some of the others in their introduction. And what brings both of us to Holden is our role as organizers with the Faith Land Initiative at the Church Council of Greater Seattle. That was a lot of very fancy titles and words and proper nouns, so we'll talk about what all of that means in, like, 5 slides. But yeah, for now, I'll pass it over to Melly.
Thanks, E. I think my mic died.
We'll see what's up with that.
Oh, you're good.
Just a little spotty. Thanks, y'all. Melly, they, them pronouns. I also am coming with E from Seattle, as they mentioned. So some of the other tribes that have their history rooted in that land would be the Stillawamish, the Snoqualmish, the Tulalip, and all other Coast Salish tribes. I also had a sort of split upbringing in a variety of different places, but predominantly the Shoshone-Bannock land in Idaho and the land of the Kumeyaay and Kish in Southern California.
Word. So a few other things we want to share with you just to get us started is what brought us personally to this work. So for myself, growing up in the East Coast, land was just sort of a given. It wasn't something that I really thought about a lot. I'll be, you know, I'm here to say I grew up in the suburbs. That was my reality. And so, yeah, you just kind of went into your house, you went into the car to get to the next place, and that was just what life was. I also only knew some of my family. On my mother's side, I was pretty deeply entrenched with those folks. They're mostly from Wilmington, North Carolina, which is a coastal city in North Carolina. But my father's side, I didn't know much about. But like many families, you often will hear little stories or snippets, things like that that kind of intrigue you. But then when you push, it's like, oh, you're not old enough yet. Or you push again when you are a little bit older, they're like, eh, that's kind of a wild story or whatever it may be at that time, right? Or there's always something else going on. And so when I graduated from undergrad, I went to school in Southern Virginia. I knew I was going to move out to Seattle, and I didn't know exactly when I would be back home for a long period of time. It was my first kind of big move ever in life. I'd always been on the East Coast, specifically in sort of D.C., the D.C. metropolitan area. And so I asked my dad, I was like, Dad, I know that we have relatives, many of them, in rural North Carolina, but I don't know anything about them. I've never met these people, and I feel like once I leave now, I don't have many reasons to come back frequently enough that I'll be able to make the trek deep into the country, similar to Holden Village, but less mountains, to get to meet these relatives. I just really wanted to do, and I kept pressing him about it. And he has a very intense relationship with his family. There's a lot of trauma there. And so I knew that this was not just something for me. This would be a big ask for him, for me to ask him to do this. And ultimately, he was like, you know, you should meet your family, and I would like to also see some of these people I haven't seen in 20 years. So we took the long journey out to rural North Carolina in an area that's between Halifax County and Warren County on Halliwa Sapani tribe land. Halliwa is literally the combo of Halifax and Warren, and then Sapani was the original tribe, and then when several tribes came together in the 70s, they became the Halliwa Sapani tribe. So yeah, that's where my family has been since at least the 1700s, and we know that because of the bill of sale records for my relatives due to slavery. So when we went there, I saw so many, literally hundreds of people that I was related to. And it was incredible because it was almost as if I had met them, you know, I'd known them my whole life. They came in, we had well water from the land that folks had been on. They showed me, like, they're sort of like, look at everything the light touches. It was very Lion King in a certain way. They're like, this is our land. And I was like, oh my God, you know, weeping. It was very, very emotional in all seriousness. And it was really the first time that I'd ever been on anything from my family on either side where I was like, this is ours. The house that I grew up in, we didn't own it. The houses or apartments or other places that people lived, I would go visit folks. You know, it was the summer house, so some of theirs, most of the banks. That's how we think of summer. And yeah, it was just ownership or stewardship in a way that people were on land for long periods of time that they could trace was not something that I understood. And I'd kind of grown to associate particularly my father's side of the family with nothing but plight. Because that was the narrative that I had seen and the narrative that I'd been told, welcome, please feel free to come in. Yeah, and so being on that land, physically touching the earth, drinking from the water, breathing in the air, traveling to get there, all that fundamentally changed my perspective when it came to land and changed the way that I approached everything after that when it came to community organizing, which deeply influenced the work that led to the Faith Land Initiative. So long and short, that experience along with everything that came after that is what brought me to this work, and I will pass it to Melly.
Thanks, E. I think my connection to land probably predates my birth a little bit. On one side, I don't know my birth my mother very well, but I know some things about her family, and one is that they were given a large parcel of land in the Teton National Forest area, Tetonia, Idaho, under the Homestead Act, which is where the government forcibly removed indigenous people from their land in order to give it away for free to anyone who would commit to settle it, which, you know, is a very destructive process. So I know that was a shared land of about 6 different tribes. And on my father's side, he has kind of a split ancestry, indigenous Hmong people on one side, and then more mestizo family line on his mother's side. He was displaced as a result of what people often call the Civil War in Guatemala, which lasted for decades. But the truth is that it was more of a U.S.-funded coup on behalf of corporate interests. So that's a story for another day. But he was kind of implicated in the resistance party of indigenous farm workers at that time. Whether or not he was involved, it didn't matter. There was cause for alarm, and he had to leave immediately for his own safety. So he landed in a few different places, starting with Arizona and eventually Los Angeles, which is a hard place for anyone to make a living. But I think especially, you know, a young man who's still, you know, learning the culture and the language and all of that. So because of those kind of two different things, my mother grew up in what's known as the Monsanto capital of the world. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Monsanto and what they do. Yes, yes, exactly.
I don't know.
She grew up just a couple miles from a Superfund site that still has not been cleaned up despite millions of dollars being sunk into it. And one of the main streets of her hometown of Soda Springs, Idaho, is known as Cancer Row. Everyone who lived on that street developed cancer, and many of them died, including young children. It's very difficult to prove that a cancer death is from poisoning, so that very little has been done, and those families, you know, continue to suffer. So that's kind of what happened before I got here. As a result of both of those different situations, my parents didn't really raise me. My mother also suffered from aggressive brain tumors and sustained significant disability in the course of those treatments. And my father struggled to make a living. So I bounced around a lot of places. I lived a lot of places and learned from a lot of people. And I didn't really feel grounded, I think, as a human being until I had the opportunity to learn from the land as the first teacher. There was a man, his name is Ezekiel Sanchez. He's a Totonac elder from the faith community that I grew up in, who had developed a program to divert youth who would otherwise go into a juvenile detention facility to go to an outdoor youth rehabilitation program where they do work with youth. And kind of the premise is generally that indigenous ways of being are healing, and that we can do more to change children's behavior by connecting them to themselves through experiences with the land and with community than we can from incarcerating them, which was a very cool opportunity that I received and attribute a lot of my personal growth to. So that's where I first kind of learned what it means to have the land as your nurturer. So in some ways, my connection to the land is that. While I might not have had a traditional family, the land was always there for me, always providing for me, and what allowed me to connect to other people in a time in my life when that was really hard. So that's me. And I'm really happy to have had those experiences and be able to be here and to do this kind of work. It feels very meaningful for me personally because of that.
Word. Thank you for that, Melly. So before we get into more of the meat of this work today, we just want to offer a few considerations for you all as we go through all of this. One of them is that we are not experts. We don't consider ourselves experts. We don't strive to be experts. The only things that we can possibly be experts of, from our opinion, is of our own personal experiences. But we are people who are practitioners. We are constantly learning. We're constantly having new experiences, and the combo of all of that leads to, you know, some wins, probably more losses, but a lot of lessons. Okay, that came naturally. A lot of lessons along the way, and ultimately, hopefully, some wisdom that we hope that we can share with you all, and also hopefully gets a lot of wisdom from you all as we go through some of these activities over the next few days. Another piece of this is that we just want to say in general, we're going to share a lot of information here, but please don't feel like you have to sit still or not take care of your own needs while we're doing this. If you need to get up and stretch, feel free to get up and stretch. You need to go to the bathroom, go to the bathroom. You suddenly need a snack, cannot blame you for that. Go and get a snack. So just wanted to name that. I feel like sometimes when you have like two people in front, there's this defaulting to like the teacher-student dynamic in a traditional way. And that's not really what this is. It's just a conversation and we're getting started with it with some grounding today. The last piece that we wanted to just lift up, again, since we have some new folks in the room, we mentioned this at the very beginning, is that this first day is going to be a little bit heavier on the talking at you side, just so we can get, once again, grounded in exactly where we're coming from, what we're doing, and sort of where we've been up to this point to facilitate better conversation and participation in the days to come. Does that sound good to everyone?
Yeah.
All right, amazing. So we've moved on to the roadmap, so here's some of the previews, what's to come. So we're going to have a land acknowledgement, but also talk a little bit about like what's beyond the land acknowledgement. We're going to talk about what is the church council, right? We're coming from this place. We're not going to assume that everybody knows where we're coming from as far as organizationally, so we're going to let y'all know what that is. In a similar vein, we're going to talk about, you know, what is the Faith Land Initiative, which is a part of the church council in which we do all of our work. We're going to get into our analysis around race and land. And this is the analysis that we share with the cohorts that we'll talk about that go through the discernment process with us. We'll also get into some of our transformative values, so kind of where we're trying to get people to versus where they're starting at. And then we'll have a light touch on the organizing spiral just to kind of once again give a preview for the rest of the week, because once we talk about the organizing spiral, you will not hear the end of it. So we're going to save that for last. And then we're hoping for 30 minutes of Q&A, but at least some Q&A, because we know that we're going to share a lot. And so we want to hear from you all and hopefully get into some more organic conversation in order to answer some of those questions that might come up. All right. So with that, let's get started with the land acknowledgement. Okay. So as we enter into our land acknowledgement, we encourage you to set your feet on the floor firmly if that feels comfortable for you. Situate yourselves generally in a comfortable position, whatever that may be. And if you feel comfortable, to close your eyes. And as we read this acknowledgement, we encourage you to try to envision the land you've traveled from and maybe call home before it was colonized. How might the water have flowed? What would the landscape look like? Who is there? Who is not? And if you're unable to see that vision, then we also encourage you to sit with the question of why. Why can't you see that vision? Now we'll read the land acknowledgement. This valley has existed for millennia, carved out by glaciers and defined by First Peoples stewardship. We stand upon the land of the Chelan, the Entiat, the Wenatchee Colville, and the Pascosa Wenatchee Yakima tribal nations. They are the original stewards of the lands where we have gathered here. We acknowledge our ongoing exploitation of the natural resources of their ancestral homeland, as well as the ongoing disparities, racism, and political invisibility experienced by Indigenous peoples of this land. We recognize our responsibility to restore as much as has been taken. We invite you to open your eyes. So, in thinking about a little bit beyond land acknowledgments, we want to lift up the words of President Robert Larson of the Lower Sioux Indian Community, and he may have said it best when he said, "An apology or an acknowledgement is one thing, but what are you going to do next?" And we hope that the time that we spend together today and the rest of this week offers at least one example or maybe even a few examples of what we and you all could possibly do next within your contexts. With that, we'll move on to what is the Church Council?
All right. So the Church Council of Greater Seattle is a faith-rooted organization that's based in South Seattle, where we both live. They've been grounded in faith and working for justice since 1919. So there's a long and rich history there. There's also a complicated history there. Originally, they were an ecumenical convening body for Christian denominations at a time when those gatherings were unheard of. And over the history of the Church Council, it's been an advocacy and direct service hub for about 103 years, dedicated to addressing social injustices through the strength of Puget Sound's faith communities. So over the course of that time, there have been a lot of headlines, right, like moments of intense activism and advocacy around pressing issues, such as solidarity with Japanese Americans during incarceration as a result of World War II. They've also supported the work to end redlining as an official practice. We say that because we know that redlining never really ended, even though we've removed it from being a policy. We've also had a long history of relationships with area tribes and supported tribal fishing rights in the Puget Sound, particularly regarding what's known as the Bolt Decision. We've supported the policy battle for the desegregation of public schools in Seattle, protested apartheid in South Africa, offered sanctuary for Central Americans who seek asylum at the border, collaborated in the Jubilee Debt Campaign and World Trade Organization resistance, and coordinated some of the largest marches protesting the Iraq War. So a lot of effort that faith communities have undertaken to act according to their conscience in our history. That said, we also acknowledge that the Church Council has sometimes been in a position of offering charity or service provision rather than a community organizing model that's based in community and based around community strengths. So we've been making a shift internally with different policies and practices over time. It's a lot of work, but we're very committed to doing it. And as a result of that, we have slightly different looking programs than we might have over the past 100 years. Which brings us to the Faithland Initiative. What we do at FLI is build collective power toward community stewardship of land, leading to a redistribution of assets and equitable development that supports communities impacted by systemic oppression. That's a lot of words. Do y'all feel like you know what we mean when we say those words? All right. So collective power, right? When we're building collective power, we're not trying to build a hierarchical power structure or a power imbalance or a power dynamic that's harmful. We're trying to build power with the people that we are among. Community power based in the individuals that comprise that community, their skills, their talents, their passions, those kinds of things, and to leverage that power towards community stewardship of land. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but when we say, you know, redistribution of assets, we literally mean redistribution of assets. We're talking about land, we're talking about money, but we're also talking about other types of community power and energy. And when we talk about equitable development, we basically mean giving communities autonomy to make decisions about how their land is used, which is rarer than you might think in certain places. So there are three major pieces of that work. The first is the Technical Brain Trust. This is a group that we're convening comprised of the community members who are most impacted by the system that we have now, where land is a commodity and people are displaced often. So that includes issue area experts and faith leaders, and their work is to support us to develop resources that make for faithful discernment of land use and development in our cohorts and some of our other work. The discernment cohort, which I just mentioned, is a learning community that we facilitate. We give congregational leaders organizing tools and kind of train them up in some of our anti-racist values that we've been trained in to practice discernment around their community stewardship of land, trying to figure out what that looks like for them and how they can move towards that. And then we also offer like long-term accompaniment and advocacy. So we will stay with congregations for as long as they want us to stay with them in their process, past the cohort. We've got some that are still very much in the thick of things years after the cohort, and we're very proud of them and their work, and we're not going anywhere. Other congregations might not feel the same pull, and that's okay. We offer what we offer, and we're there for as much or as little as people need us. Where we kind of have our boundaries around what accompaniment means is that we're looking for folks who are working to do equitable community development, redistribution of assets, or community stewardship of land. So that's kind of our focus and where we go with that. So this can look like a lot of different things, but some of the work that we've been involved in over the past couple years. Last year, we successfully advocated for density bonus legislation. What this did was allow faith communities who own their land to develop at a higher density than it would otherwise be zoned for. So this made it more feasible specifically for Black churches to redevelop their land and provide affordable housing when it would have otherwise been financially more difficult or mathematically impossible. We also have ongoing participation in the King County Equitable Development Initiative, which is a work group of community members who are working to develop and identify funding sources and criteria for county-sponsored equitable development projects. I am going to take a sip of water. I don't know if you can tell, but a lot of talking, so I'm a little dry in the mouth. E, can you take the other two? Thanks.
Yep, no worries at all. So we've also launched a community training series. So we realized we were doing a lot of shifting internally. Like Melly said earlier, some of our outward-facing programs are starting to look different, but we do have a wide base of folks who had no idea what was going on. Right, they've known the church council to be one thing. Here we were showing up as a whole different thing. We also had a lot of staff turnover in the process of this, so a whole different set of faces. People were like, hold on, like, this all sounds great, but like, where do we fit? Right, we've been in this for 50 years with y'all, and you didn't even let us know you were like changing up the game. So we launched very recently a community training series to basically let congregations in on some of these different things that we've been working on internally. So whether it's our community organizing methods, whether it's the anti-racist values that we're putting into practice on an organizational level and also putting throughout our Faithland Initiative work, trying to let people know, like share the wealth a little bit. This is great information that we've been given, a deep struggle, principled struggle that we've been trying to go through as an organization and also bring some congregations along through the Faithland Initiative work. So having a bit of training around that, that's more outward facing. The last piece, we just want to really uplift the accompaniment of the cohort members because there's some pretty cool examples, and some of this will be detailed with a little bit more flavor in the rest of the week to kind of paint the picture of what we do. But for today, Melly had already mentioned that we do support some of the congregations that tap in with us post their sort of discernment process. So when we talk about discernment, we'll talk about this a little bit more deeply later, but that period of time where a congregation has enough energy, there's enough members galvanized, they're like, we do need to do something, and we need to do it intentionally. We don't just want to make a rash decision, especially about the future of potentially very large and valuable in a variety of ways assets. But they're not at the point of actually, you know, trying to reach a consensus decision. And so in that time of discernment, that's where we meet them. And there's a wide spectrum of what that looks like. But after they have made that decision, you can make a decision, and we probably all have experienced this, and still be like, okay, so I decided I'm going to do this. Now I actually have to do it. That's hard. It's hard for individuals. It's even harder for congregations and faith communities. And so we do also support them in that. And so two that we want to lift up is that we do have two congregations that have completed their discernment processes. One has approved a land transfer. We actually got this news like the first day that we got to Holden's. This is big time. Live and direct before the press release. Yes, one approved a land transfer to a mutual aid collective led by trans folks of color and another has partnered with a developer to construct affordable housing units that are specifically queer-affirming, because we know that homelessness, housing insecurity, especially affects the LGBTQIA community, and so there, this was a heart issue, particularly for this congregation. Alright, so, pictures of me at a different time of my life. Yes, so...
Welcome. All of you.
Yeah, so someone's younger than... that's really cool. How did it happen? So a little bit of story time. So I've been at the church council since 2017. I mentioned earlier that I moved to Seattle almost 5 years ago, and the church council was the job that I had upon moving to Seattle through a fellowship with the United Church of Christ. In my early days at the church council, I was in a different role than I am in, I'm in today. I kind of partially created this role for myself in a certain way. And the role that I came into the church council doing was a housing justice organizer. So at the time, we had a very different community organizing model, because you might be asking yourself, how did you move to Seattle and become a housing justice organizer? I also asked myself that question. But it was much more framed as a learning experience, because I was 22 at the time and trying to really figure out what did it look like to like professionally organize. So long and short of it is there have been a number of pretty major municipal and even countywide battles, political battles that have gone on in Seattle between 2017 to 2018. Several of them had to do with dealing with the homelessness crisis, which is one of the worst in the country in Seattle, Washington, also with housing affordability, which was terrible then and is worse now in the area as well. And so people, especially faith communities, we really rallied to try to include sort of the moral voice in a certain way around these issues, because Seattle loves to be in our head with very little spiritual analysis, very little heart. In a lot of ways, sometimes when it comes to the issues. So that was the role of faith communities in these fights. After that year of just intense going to City Hall all the time, talking with elected officials, kind of the classic campaign mode, I kind of wanted to do my due diligence as an organizer and check in with the various faith communities from these congregations across the city, predominantly white congregations, which will be relevant in a moment, who had been involved, and see where were they at, were they ready, they have another fight, you know, in them, because there's always more to do. Here I was, you know, at like 23, I had all the energy in the world. That's not true anymore. And so started to have those conversations. And what was really interesting is, you know, just a few months before, these different leaders and their congregations have been kind of gunning to be part of this process, the political process in Seattle. But when I was talking to them now, they indicated that it wasn't that their values had changed, but their capacity had. And when I would press them on, you know, what did that mean, they would say, well, the building that we're in or the asset that we're stewarding, so like a parking lot or development that was pressing upon the area where they were currently located, or failing infrastructure as far as the actual building they were in, or a parsonage, or you can kind of fill in the blanks here, that these things were occupying a lot of their time. It was also occupying the time of other faith leaders, so not just pastors, but also laity, that many different committees were being formed to try to figure out, you know, how do we deal with the vitality issue in our faith community? How do we deal with the fact that bricks are literally falling off the building and it's becoming a hazard to remain here? Never mind the fact that it's not retrofitted and we're overdue for a massive earthquake in Seattle at any moment. Mm-hmm. So all of these things, and the city was also pressing congregations about this as well. So it wasn't just an internal pressure. It was also an external pressure in a lot of ways, plus the financial feasibility of the whole thing. These were the things that they were telling me, and that was not what I was expecting. And I heard it so many different places from so many different types of faith leaders, from so many different types of faith communities. And so I'd ask them, well, what do you think you're going to do? And they would say, well, we've either been fighting about it for 20 years, so we have no idea, or we've just started talking about it now, so we don't have a lot of vision, but we know we have to do something. There's a sense of urgency. And I was like, great, you know, taking my notes. I'm going to take this back to the staff and see if anybody has any ideas about what to do with the situation. And when I took it back to the other organizers on staff, I was also surprised to hear that they all had been having these conversations. All had been going in, trying to do the work that we were there to do, and instead were being met with conversations around viability of these faith communities from a physical and a sort of congregational level. And so we realized that there was something there. On the other side of this, in a certain way, I was also in a lot of coalition spaces in communities of color. And in these different coalition spaces and also just like informal conversations I was having, bopping around the community, this is like pre-COVID, so you could do things like bop around the community. I was hearing over and over again these incredible articulations, sometimes even like full out plans had already been made with all kinds of vision and innovation around what these groups wanted to do if they had the space, if they had the money, if they had the land. But when I would ask, well, what's kind of stopping you from making this, you know, incredible vision into a reality? Well, consistently it was that we don't have the assets, and trying to get those assets in a timely fashion, particularly in a white hot real estate market, and especially in these high displacement areas, I see some nods already, like you already kind of see the picture that's being painted here, right? So as this is over a course of several months, I'm having all these conversations at the same time, hearing from my colleagues at the same time. This conversation is percolating. It's very relevant. And it started to myself and to my colleagues, it started to paint a certain picture. One, congregations are asking for help. They're asking point blank, we don't know what we're doing. We hope that somebody will know how to help us. Mm-hmm. At any point, they could have sold the different assets that they had and cleaned up. They didn't have to tell anybody that they didn't have to discern. They didn't have to talk about it. They could have just gone to the highest bidder, which would have just been a market rate developer, and called it good. But they specifically didn't want to do that. And we often tell congregations who express interest in the cohort and say, well, we might want to just sell it. If you just want to sell it, this is not the experience for you. We might discourage you from doing that, but it's not the experience for you. But if you're trying to do things differently, well, then maybe we should talk. So long and short of it, this series of conversations and just realities within our context is what led to first the Faithland Discernment Cohort and then later the Faithland Initiative.
So there I was in peak pandemic Googling things like squatters' rights and composting toilets. When I was laid off from my health and welfare job, and even though I was very concerned for like my family's future, I was also low-key ecstatic to be spending so much quality time with them and realizing how I had worked in a really terrible environment as a government worker, doing, you know, six jobs in one and all of that. And then someone sent me on social media the posting for the Faithland organizer hiring, and I got my stuff together so fast. I think in about 24 hours, I was like, all right. I'd spent all this time, you know, marinating in the outrage, right, as I'm sure many of us were, and thinking about how if there was one thing that I wanted to be able to do with my life, it would be to take some of these masses and masses of concrete that we have and break up just a little bit of it for something green to grow there. And I feel like that's the work that the Faithland Initiative is doing, and that's why I joined on. So I joined the staff in 2021, and I'm stoked to be here, and excited to talk to you a little bit more about why we're doing the work that we're doing. So nationwide, there is a ton of land that is held by faith communities. So much of it, and not all of it, is really being used. And when we say underutilized land, I kind of feel like there's like sort of a quotations there, like underutilized according to who, stuttering again, according to who. Sometimes we look at land that's like fallow or underutilized when the land is just resting, or maybe the land is recovering. So we kind of want to always honor that means a different thing than what people typically think of. Usually when we say underutilized, people think of an empty space, and that's not what we're talking about. So in the D.C. metropolitan area, that looks like 800 vacant parcels, making up almost 726 acres of land that's owned by faith communities that could be used for something more transformative in community. In Seattle, that's 300 acres of land. Many of those acres are also underutilized and eligible for development according to Seattle zoning. In California, there's actually an entire city's worth of land. So 38,800 acres, the size of Stockton, and 45% of that land is in areas where wealth and power has been hoarded. I think they call these high resource areas. They have different names for them, but essentially what it means is wealth and power have been consolidated in these areas, and they have more access to transportation, so lower greenhouse gas emissions, things like that, and also better schools. More trees, all kinds of things. So that's a really significant number. So there's definitely the opportunity to do something big here if we can get faith communities on board. Which brings us to one of the most important things that we need for faith communities to understand in order to undertake this work, which is the intersection of race and land. How we perceive land, how we use land, how we commodify land, all of those things. E, do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about why community stewardship of land specifically is important. So everything touches the land: indigenous sovereignty, renters' rights, immigration, healthcare, disability justice, farm workers' rights, obviously housing justice, and all other many modern-day ills, unfortunately, of colonial violence also touch the land. Even the current conditions of our ongoing pandemic can be attributed to our current distribution methods and agricultural drivers between the pathogens transferring to humans. But the wisdom of indigenous communities teach us that the same things that impact the land, also the land can heal us. It can heal us of those things. So land is treated as a commodity instead of our nurturer, and as a result, it is constantly in transition. The speculative market is constantly raising the price of an acre while simultaneously depressing the incomes of the people who are cultivating that land and producing the food we all eat. In the next 2 decades, it's predicted that 400 million acres of U.S. farmland will change hands. And currently, Black communities lose 30,000 acres of land annually. Privileged communities have often conserved the right to exert local control over the way that their land is used and developed. And we see this when laws and policies are violated, often, in order to push through land thefts through eminent domain, for example, when it serves corporate or governmental interests. But what is possible when the people who have the most intimate relationships with the land also have the power to determine as a community what happens on this land? When we stop seeing land as a commodity and see it instead as a precious relative that nurtures us, we can exist with the land in ways that support its longevity and the wellness of our communities instead of expanding profits.
I think one of the reasons why we also want to do this work with faith communities specifically is that land is not the only resource that they have. They're also just inherently groups of people who come together with common goals, common values, and a mutual interest in each other. Right, a commitment to love and support one another. And that's a really hard thing to find in organizing spaces. There's a lot of community work that has to be done in order to build relationships up to that level. So in another way, faith communities are also resource-rich in order to do this land. And so that's why we kind of approach this work that way. When we say the word discernment, that's a word, right, that's used very often in many faith communities. So it's a spiritual process embarked upon to facilitate grounded decision-making. As we shared earlier, most of the faith communities we work with could have easily just sold their parsonages, their parking lots, houses of worship, all the things that go along with that, right? Like air rights even. So there's a long list of things and advantages to making that kind of a choice and sort of cleaned up, right? Seattle is a very lucrative place to sell a property. Always, continually, more and more and more, as we talked about earlier. So they've chosen not to do that because that action wouldn't align with their values. And from the FLI side, as organizers, we see how an anti-racist relational organizing approach to discernment helps build community members from the inside and the outside. So in a way that deeply honors the dignity of the process, the land, underrepresented members of the community, while also allowing sort of a mechanism for accountability, right? Like, we're here to support faith communities, but we're also here on behalf of the broader community, understanding what they need and want from us, and being able to kind of manage that relationship in between both.
Right. Last but not least, we just want to talk about the cohort process itself and why we do this work collectively as opposed to just on an individual basis. So we structured discernment through a cohort model because we believe in the power of learning collectively, and we're going to talk about that more over the course of this week. No faith community comes to the cohort as an empty vessel or solely as holders of land or cash assets. Each of them is comprised of human beings, most of the time trying their best to do right by what they're stewarding in the ways that they know how. However, they've come to the cohort because they've hit sort of a limit when it comes to that knowledge, and it hinders a robust discernment process towards a consensus decision. Discernment, like we mentioned earlier, is a wide spectrum, and some faith communities are farther along than others, and that's a beautiful thing, because they have a lot of knowledge to share in a cohort process. Others may have compelling visions that they're able to articulate, which may inspire folks to dream a little bit bigger, or maybe for other folks to dream differently in ways that help them steward land in ways that they may not have thought previously possible. But ultimately, we are really encouraging these faith communities to not just think of the land that they're on differently, but also of themselves differently. So we're really encouraging them to transform their culture from the inside out in order to support this decision-making process, shifting from white institutional values to transformational values, from identifying as a landowner to seeing themselves and operating as land stewards. But these are not easy concepts to go through alone. A cohort process helps for accountability as folks work through what it means to transform themselves and their communities in relationship to land. So with that, we know we've just gone through a lot. We also know it's like 4:10. So we want to break a little bit for a stretch. Are y'all up for a stretch?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're able to, please rise. I promise we're not going to like sing the national anthem. All right, so we're going to do something. Try to get a little bit of like an arm's length of space. You can maybe stagger exactly. Find your window. Great. Okay, we're going to do what's called the organizer stretch. Now, I'm just going to say right now, this is not something that you can attribute to one person. So I've seen it done probably 500 ways, and each way was done differently. So I'm going to make mine up today. Okay. So first we're going to stretch up, and we're going to reach for the stars. Reach for the visions that our communities have proclaimed long ago and up to the present day. Reach for a better world and really get up there. And then we're going to drop it low. We're going to reach down. And this way we're going to the grassroots, y'all. We got to get all the way to the root. So you got to really bend down there. Touch the land. Find the people that everyone else discounts. We're going to bring those voices, that power, into the space. And then we're going to reach, stand up a little bit, and then reach side to side, because we're building a broad-based coalition, okay? So we really have to go across town one way and across town the other and bring disparate peoples together so we can have that conversation only we can have. And last but not least, we're going to bring it around town. Bring it around town. Make sure you go both ways, okay? Because we have to make sure that it's accessible. We can't just be having these conversations and expecting people to show up. We got to have a circle process to make sure everyone's voice is heard. And make sure we're getting the word out to the places that are easy to miss. And last but not least, we're going to shake it out. We are shaking off the bonds of injustice. We are shaking off white institutional values. We are shaking off the various isms and phobias, but we're also doing the work. We're not just shaking it off, okay? And we're feeling all the joy that comes with being in our bodies, embodied people with other embodied people, making a better world. Woo!
Congratulations, you've done it. You've learned the organizing stuff. You can go. No, I'm just kidding. That's not the organizing spiral, but we should teach you that in the future. All right. So coming back a little bit more grounded, out of curiosity, how many of you were at Vance Black Fox's exercise this morning? Seeing a pretty good show of hands. Great. This has eliminated the need for us to do a lot more talking. So thank you for doing that, making the effort to show up, because one of the things that we really wanted to talk about is the history of the land. So given that, can anyone kind of offer up some of the things that you've learned today about the impact, like the history of missional colonialism? Feel free to just kind of call it out. If you're more comfortable raising hands, we can also do that. You're nerds, but we can do it.
Obliteration of other people's realities. Did that as a white people and as a people, I guess.
Doing it based on the doctrine of discovery, which was from the Pope, from the church, that
the church was really a driving factor in that, or a legitimizing factor.
Absolutely. Do you think you can elaborate a little bit for folks who weren't there what the doctrine of discovery was?
Basically, the Pope's saying that if you go to lands, you can take what you want. I think there was a clause about if they weren't Christian, you could do it. So yeah. That was kind of
the famous. Civilized. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. Can anyone think of anything else they want to offer up? Part of that history?
The continued ways in which the church can destroys land and families and culture in places like the through mediums like the boarding schools and support of legislations and policies that allow folks to be dehumanized and considered uncivilized.
Absolutely. That was one of my main takeaways from that exercise as well, right? That second F for all the violence, then also like the death of dreams and culture. It's a huge one. Marika, I saw you kind of putting your hand up.
This government sanctioned, you know, this idea of treaties that people entered into as a, seeing it as something that was like coming together when actually the government was, it was all about tearing people apart and their land, taking their lands from them.
Definitely.
Something with that is that just the corruption of the conversion process, that, you know, we're going to come convert you, and it's just like, yeah, I mean, it wasn't Christianity, it was just some kind of icky thing that, you know, the Catholic Church, but a lot of the churches and faiths, was it the Methodist from the kind of slavery, I think, was the Methodist or Presbyterian Methodist, but in the South were kind of, you know, made up their whole story about slavery. And
yeah, that was discussed also in Asa's presentation earlier this morning, about how like biblical language, scripture, has been historically used to justify the enslavement and dignity takings of African peoples, extracting a lot of resources, right? We know that pretty much all of the wealth that has been built in the United States has been extracted from other countries. Particularly Africa, Asia, and South and Central America. Also just kind of the enshrining cultural norms of whiteness, right? Like creating that normalcy that says, like, this is how people are, this is how society is, when that's a violence towards indigenous peoples and people in other lands that we have exploited, despite the fact that we'll take their resources, right? But we'll leave the culture aside. Which kind of brings us to the next point, that when we're talking about the intersection, right, of like land use and race, that one of the most important foundations we need from folks who are trying to undertake this work is an understanding of why we center Black people in that work.
Yes, so to pick up that baton, this is just a fact. No matter where you go, the darker your skin, the more African your features, the worse you're treated. It doesn't really matter. You can be in the United States. You can be across the world. You can be in sovereign states. You can be in more colonial states. That is true across the world. And what I've just described is anti-Blackness. So I'm going to provide a definition because we don't want to assume that everyone knows what we're talking about when we say that. So reading that aloud. Anti-Blackness is the term used to specifically describe unique discrimination, violence, and harms imposed upon and impacting Black people specifically. This can look like covert anti-Black racism, which often takes the form of structural racism, and overt anti-Black racism, which may take the form of what are considered micro and macro aggressions. Personally, I think if it's an aggression, it's an aggression, but those are the terms that we use. These aggressions can come from non-Black people of color, and they can also come from white people. From our perspective, we see anti-Black structural racism as the foundational architecture for the strategies, tactics, tools, and cultural worldviews that propagate and maintain racial oppression, and exclusion in the U.S. and the world. And we make this a point to center this in our racial justice and anti-racism in our analysis, because sometimes we'll try to have this conversation and people want to play the oppression Olympics. Mm-hmm. We are not going to play the oppression Olympics. There are some facts in terms of how the policy has been shaped, particularly within the United States context in which we are working. And so we're going to uplift some of those examples. We'll have the time for a question and answer at the end. Can you hold your question? Great. So some examples of this, we've already talked about missional colonialism. My friend in the front did uplift some of the ways, specific ways that denominations and certain sects of Christianity have specifically embarked on missional colonialism and how that has specifically impacted African peoples, which leads us directly into the entire system of chattel slavery. Sharecropping, shortly after that. Jim Crow laws, right along the same time as that. Exclusion from the New Deal. Redlining in both practice and policy. Tribal exclusion. Predatory mortgage lending by major banks, such as the example of the 2008 housing bubble burst and financial crisis. Environmental racism. Deflated housing valuation due to race. Mass incarceration. And these are just a few. You know, we're not going to go too deep today. We can always talk about resources maybe after this session as far as like specific books that touch on each of those things, because there's so much more. We're trying to paint a picture here, right, of the policies and the practices that have started years ago and are ongoing today as far as their impacts and sometimes even still being on the books that have specifically kept Black peoples, and in this case, African-American people and Afro-Indigenous people, from being able to access land and housing in the ways that other folks, even other people of color, have been able to access land and housing in within this United States context. So simply put, just to round all this out before we transition, we center Black people in our work because when Black people in this country are truly free from anti-Blackness and all of its forms, everyone benefits. We do not believe that we can fully work toward undoing racism, which is at the heart of this work, without this lens in all of our race and land analysis. Is that landing with everyone? We're feeling this? Okay. Either way, we're going to move on. So. Okay, so we've talked a lot about, kind of alluded to, what our anti-racism framework is. We can send this to you all. We apologize for, like, the graininess of the quality. We tried to make it better. But yes. So this comes from Crossroads Anti-Racism. Something that we try our best to do is always attribute the work that we have been trained on to make sure that, you know, if you all are interested in this stuff, you can obviously, bless you, talk to us about it, but we will just point you towards these people. So might as well just go to the source. So Crossroads Anti-Racism actually now is its own entity, not connected to any faith tradition, but it actually started working specifically with Christian congregations around undoing anti-racism in that institutional sense. So it's very well suited for the type of work we're trying to do with faith communities in our work as well. So I just kind of want to go over a high-level overview of some of the values that we identify within the white institutions, i.e. the congregations that we work with, because we do work predominantly with white congregations. They have a unique responsibility in this work, and with the history of the church council, it aligns very well for us to be the ones who are holding these relationships. So one of the things is either-or thinking. So either-or thinking, it's very, like, as we would say, black and white or binary thinking. The ways that this shows up in some of our discernment work can be they have one idea of what they could do. Oftentimes, it's usually the more palatable idea, i.e. development in a certain way, right? That's very much, that's hot. It sounds good to people to just redevelop something. Sometimes development is great. And sometimes it's worthwhile to look at other and explore other avenues. But when you have either-or thinking, a leader may say, look, this is what we're going to do, and no other idea can be considered up to the same par as that idea because that person has said it and that's sort of embedded in the culture of the place. So either-or thinking, we see this a lot in the work. Another thing is the scarcity mentality. So where this shows up really concretely is in budgeting. I'm hearing you. Okay. Yes, in the budget process. And this is a reality. We want to acknowledge that there's sometimes that the money might be looking a little funny sometimes. And that often that is what's actually bringing people to this work, even more so than their love of the mission or what the community needs or things of that nature. We're not trying to be naive about it. And at the same time, we want to encourage people to shift to an abundant perspective and look at some of the assets that they do have as opposed to hyper-focusing on what they receive they do not have. We can talk about this more when we get to the transforming institutional values. At the bottom here, we talk about secrecy. So secrecy, there's a difference between confidentiality and secrecy. Those two things often get conflated. So we often see this play out in hierarchical, particularly very hierarchical polities, and how those polities can kind of trickle down from, you know, high up within denominations into the local church context. So sometimes just very important information that's necessary for an informed discernment process will not be available to the leaders, especially to the laity, who need that information to move forward and have them productive and generative discussions. And that'll be under the concept of, oh, it's confidential. Well, is it confidential or is this a product of secrecy? Going to the side here, competitive individualism. So this is sort of the idea of there might be one person, there may be a group of leaders, but one person who feels like, this is my job and I'm the only one who can do it, and without me, everything will fail, even though no one ever said that. And they never asked for help, never even looked around for help, right? And then when inevitably whatever the process, the project, the research, whatever it may be in the discernment process, falls upon this individual who's made it, like, I'm going to elbow everybody out the way to be the one who gets the credit, and then they don't do it, well, what do we do next, right? Because they've hoarded a lot of the power in that process. They may have engaged in some secrecy. There's a certain level of scarcity mentality. I'm the only one who can do it, even if that's not actually true. You're kind of seeing how these things come together. So let's look towards the middle here. All these things work together, right? One really does not exist without the other. If we see one, over time, people may, like, you know, put on the good face for the first couple of cohort meetings, but we start to have those deeper, more real conversations, and all of them start to come out in pretty obvious ways. And so what it's summed up here as is relationships misshaped by consolidated power and hierarchical accountability. So it's not to say that there's no accountability. It's just to say that it's hierarchical accountability. Hierarchies sometimes have their place with intention. Rarely in these spaces that we're seeing, in these faith communities that we're engaging with, has a hierarchy ever been discussed. It just exists. And it's been replicated as a consequence of the white institutional values over time. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, that's where we start most of the time with our congregations. This is where we're hoping to go. So transforming institutional values. So you notice how before everything was pointed inward. It makes everything smaller, more crunched. This expands. It pushes things outward. So at the top, starting again, we think about both and thinking. Just expanding your thinking, acknowledging that there can be more than one right way to do something, more than one right idea. Abundant worldview, talked about this a bit with the budget example, but the idea that, yes, there may be a level of not enoughness, a feeling of not enough in one area of the congregation, the faith community. But what do you have? Really looking at things from an assets-based perspective so that that can shape a more imaginative way of looking at the options, encouraging the both and thinking. Mm-hmm. Going to the bottom, engaging in transparent communication and decision-making. This is a hard one because all these other things that we saw on the previous slide all trickle into our communication styles and patterns. So while we may be trying to shift an overall organization's culture, which in and of itself is enough of a process, or a faith community's culture within that as well, actually getting people to say things differently, to engage with each other differently, to run meetings differently is a very hard thing to do. But it is something that's actually extremely important. Having even just a basic example of this is not having the same facilitator at every meeting. Having more than one facilitator at all of the meetings. Actually checking in with people so that there's not an assumption that every single week we're going to have the meeting at the exact same time, because we've always had the meeting at the exact same time. Well, does that work for people who have kids? Does it work for people who maybe can't sit in front of a screen if you're still engaging in that type of meeting style? Or maybe who can't come in person or have to go through traffic to make it there but really want to be involved and actually have a lot they could offer? Just basic things like that, just taking a moment to talk about transparent communication decision-making can really open up the possibilities of who can be in the room, what kind of conversations can be had because different people are in the room. All these things are possible. Moving to the side here, we have collaboration and cooperation. This is one that we're still working on at the church council, to be really honest with you all, because sometimes you can almost over-collaborate, right? So there's a point at which you're doing the work, you're trying to get people in on every single decision. It feels good, right? It slows things down sometimes in a good way,
but also sometimes not always in a good way. Yeah. And there can also be a point at which people who are perceived as having more capabilities or skills end up holding the bulk of what the work of the collaboration. Well, everyone gets to take credit for, well, we delegated that responsibility to insert person here because they're really good at it and we wanted to collaborate. Well, is that collaboration? You know, maybe not. So working on it, but it's something to note in the discernment process because, once again, it can't all fall on one person or one group within a congregation or faith community. It needs to be more open for folks to be able to move forward in the discernment process. All of these things together, working together, focus on accountable and responsible relationships with broadly shared power, and they become possible when you work with all these things together. Just lifting up one example of this very briefly, there's a congregation that we, I guess, technically are finished working with, but have been working with for the last few months, and I would say they are probably one of the best examples of a predominantly white congregation that does really practice all of these things. Mm-hmm. Now, did they do that overnight? No. And they will tell you they didn't do it overnight. It took them almost 5 years since the official start of their discernment process to go from identifying, hey, we need to do something, to we have done the thing, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not overnight work, but it's deeply impactful and important work. And like we mentioned before, at the beginning of all of this, you have the final sort of outcome, right, of having made the decision, having done something that ideally will benefit the community, but it also does benefit the faith community. It's not just about going out. It also is about turning in and then working with together. Mm-hmm. This resonating with folks?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The last thing I'll note here is this, this sort of bolded part at the bottom that says transforming values, often in conflict, unsurprisingly, with traditional white institutional values, cultivate terrain for anti-racist accountability to germinate. Mm-hmm. And I just love the way that they said that. So I wanted to read it out loud. Make sure y'all didn't miss it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving forward. Okay, so we mentioned before the concept, and this is really the title of this whole talk, is moving from a landowner perspective to a land steward perspective. So this is our work in progress take on the values that we learned from Crossroads Anti-Racism and trying to transfer them into that sort of into that perspective with our community so that it would resonate in ways in case it was kind of going over people's heads. So really the thing I want to focus on here is the central block, where it says our role as buyer, seller, settler, landlord manipulates land and other assets as a commodity to be taken, owned, or traded. This is a reality of working within the system. It doesn't mean that people have to sit in shame about it or that faith communities can sort of become lethargic and weighed down by the reality of what the situation is. It's just naming what is so that we can move towards what could be. And what could be is an idea of stewardship. So focusing on the middle here, our role as stewards liberates land and other assets as a blessing that's part of a divine ecology of shalom. Shalom meaning working for peace and justice. I really like to think about this language as far as divine ecology language, right? To sort of bring together our relationship as human beings with the land and not as two separate things. So we have a task, we've been given something very precious, which is land, and it's also a relative, right, that we have to steward gracefully within the context that we're in. And so we're encouraging folks to say, you know, you're in a system currently, what can you do to subvert that system with the institutional access and power that you have, recognizing the need that's been articulated.
So keeping an eye on the time, I'm going to try to get through these next pieces fairly briefly, knowing that in some of these other sessions we'll have time for a deeper dive. So one of the things that we say is solidarity before scale. And one brief example of this would be a congregation that recognized the need to provide as much affordable housing as possible for as many people who needed housing, right, historically excluded from housing as possible, and came up with a blueprint that was a bunch of one bedrooms. And then realizing after the fact that the people who are the farthest from median income are actually people who have children. Mm-hmm. So needing to go back, revisit their plans, and that this happens when we're not in relationship with the people that we're trying to serve, right? That's why that comes first. If you have true solidarity with folks, you recognize that you don't need to scale things up. You don't need to try to replicate efforts identically in another place according to like a to-do list or a step 1 through 5. It doesn't work like that. And that's one thing that we really need faith communities to understand when they're going into this work, that you have no concept of what it's going to look like at the end until you have already done that relational work of building solidarity with other people. There's one quote that I use often from a sociologist that says, you know, when you do change for other people, they experience it as violence, but when people do change for themselves, they experience it as liberation. Mm-hmm. And I think in our organizing experience, that's really proved true. So that brings us into our general overview of the organizing spiral, which I'll let E introduce.
All right, so the organizing spiral, like we mentioned earlier, this is also at the crux of our work. I just want to say from the beginning that we did not invent the organizing spiral. Anyone who's been in a community organizing space for a while will probably have seen some version of this. It also sometimes is called the organizing cycle. Basically, this is something that's been passed down through many community organizing lineages. We've just adapted it for these purposes. And it's a way, it basically serves as a tool, or facilitates a way to introduce more tools for our faith communities that are going through the work with us. So, kicking things off with Listen, I just want to read a really cool quote here. So, activism is making coffee, serving elders, cooking, getting to know each other in a very deep way, that developed that trust so that we can have joy. And that is from Louise Brady, Tlingit Elder. So I read that quote to say that listening is the foundation of trust. It's a way to embody empathy and solidarity. True listening creates the possibility for us to co-create the beloved community, God's movement, and the world. Learning and unlearning more about the stories, people, and places and land around us. The tools that we use to practice listening are as simple as they are effective. So it looks like the one-to-one conversation, which we will explore in the days to come. On a larger scale, it can look like community listening sessions. In some cases, community-centered research, which really interacts well with community listening sessions, person-centered planning, and supportive decision-making.
After that, once we've kind of done that baseline listening, which is a lot more work than we think it is, right? Because there's so much that we have to remove from ourselves in order to be able to really do that deep listening. Then we move into the next part. We've done our listening. We've recognized how much we need to learn about, ideally. That should be the product of any proper listening, is the acknowledgement of that gap. So listening is why we start there. And notice in the spiral, it starts kind of smaller in the center. That's because we're hoping that people kind of start with themselves, that they sort of apply this to themselves individually first before going out into the wider community. So then moving into learn, you know, we learn in order to see the world and our place in it clearly. So this is how we educate ourselves and form relationships that move us towards accountable action, with emphasis on accountable, recognizing that there's always going to be unintended consequences to decisions that we make, and that we want to have the types of relationships with people that we're limiting the amount of harm we can do, right? If we're having a hierarchical power imbalance, when we make a mistake, that's going to harm a lot of people a lot more deeply than it would if that were not the case. So we don't learn alone. We learn in community together. So some of the tools that we use to support folks in their learning are things like community-centered research, listening sessions, research meetings, political and popular education models to kind of build that critical awareness. We always encourage folks to make sure that this is the part where they're bringing those relationships into play, where they're doing that learning in community with people who have experiences that are very different than their own.
I do want to uplift one thing we see frequently in the discernment process amongst predominantly white congregations when it comes to learn. So people will be all in for getting to know the people within their faith community, sometimes within the larger sort of local community, to have those conversations, sit down with a cup of coffee, take the notes, to move forward in the discernment. They're really jazzed to learn, because we know that we love a study group. So people will read all kinds of books. They'll have all kinds of Bible studies, which for folks who were in Vance Black Fox's session earlier, there's nothing wrong with that. But what we see consistently is that predominantly white congregations specifically get stuck at learn, get stuck towards lethargy and an inability to act. There's sort of this like, the foot is up, we're about to step. No, we can't put the other foot down. Right. So something that we consistently have to encourage our congregations to not do or to push themselves through when we're in our cohort sessions together is to move past the learn stage, because people want to become experts in every single thing that has to do with the potential, the various potential realities for their faith community in this discernment process. But as we said before, you have to be open to a little bit of uncertainty when you're truly engaging with the community, which means you're not going to ever learn everything. And frankly, if you are the only ones who are learning all the things and hoarding that knowledge, you're replicating a power imbalance. That's not good. Now is the time to expand that network, like we talked about before, and bring in some other voices, some other perspectives, some other knowledge holders to help move you along so that you can act responsibly and accountably, as Melly was talking about before.
Absolutely. So I think that kind of stumbling block before ACT, it's sort of this view of the spiral as being just, you know, a checklist, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, done. So all of the learning for an ultimate, you know, the most perfect action that we can ever take has to be done right now. And what we talk about when we talk about ACT is like doing the next best thing. What is the next best thing in front of you that's going to take you along that spiral? You will do more learning after that. But with the learning you have right now, with the people you have in the room right now, with the resources you have right now, what's the next action that you can take to show up? So that's what we mean when we say ACT. It's taking action rooted in the listening and learning that you've done. That's a tangible way that you're deepening relationships and community by showing up in solidarity. And you're embodying the change that we're working towards, right? This is an outward manifestation of those values that we've talked about being internalized and taken to heart. Action moves us out of that sort of talking and dreaming about what we want towards decisive outcomes that make that possible.
Finally, last but certainly not least, we have reflect. Another dynamic that we see in pretty much all congregations, and frankly, this is just a dynamic in most of, I would say, the Western world, we often fail to reflect. We will listen sometimes. We will learn often. We may act, though it may often be performative, and we'll talk about that in the days to come. But reflecting is not really something that we do. Usually we act, and then we run back to probably act again, usually. It's just sort of a cycle of endless action. And we kind of have seen with the state of the world where that has gotten us. So reflection invites us to slow down, to not act in urgency, to honor the legacies that have shaped us. Slowing down to reflect is deeply countercultural. Reflection creates a sacred pause for us to be still, listen to others, listen to God's voice, and draw out wisdom from our shared experiences. Reflection is critical to our next steps, building on our successes while still being accountable for the impacts of our actions. You have to build in time and space to be accountable. Continuing to act will just build up a longer laundry list of the things that you probably need to atone for. So some tools that we like to use around this include appreciative inquiry, evaluation, and also celebration. Because oftentimes, particularly in this sort of fuzzy, kind of gray area political space, what can you can be in a celebration because you had a win, and it may not feel like a win. You may have made the decision within your faith community context, and some people might be like, you know, I'm not going to block this from happening, but I'm not also going to say jump up and down about it either. That still can be considered a win, but what is the reflection process for saying, well, why does it feel like that? Why doesn't it feel like a win for some people? What does it look like in our next discernment process, maybe about a different thing, for this to look different so that everyone can kind of feel jazzed about it at the end and we can celebrate in a more meaningful way? So, kind of wrap this thing up. Consider for the following sessions, because we'll kind of return to this question. Historically and in the present day, what connection do you, your families, and or your faith communities have to land? We'll be returning to this in a variety of ways, using some of the tools that we mentioned over the course of today, and really hoping to hear some pretty like generative conversations amongst folks as people consider and reflect, you know, what is your relationship to the land?
Yes, so this is kind of the journey we're trying to take you on this week. So as we mentioned, today is a lot of talking. We'll be doing a bit more community discussion. We'll have breakout groups, collaboration. So always the same room, always at 3:30. I know there's lots of stuff that y'all could be doing, but feel free to have a conversation with others about what you learned today from when we were talking. bring folks with you, it's okay. We'll just rely on you to clue them in a little bit. So tomorrow we'll be focusing on the listen and learn stages of the organizing cycle and like what that looks like, and kind of having some breakout groups to discuss how this shows up already and how it might be different in the future. Then on Thursday, we'll be focusing on the act and reflect stages. And finally, on Friday, we're going to kind of support you to kick off your own sort of discernment process, seeing yourself connected to this work with a visioning towards a restoration exercise. Sometimes when we talk about reparations, we kind of get lost in like, oh, it's like a balance that has to be transferred, when really so much more, it's like a dignity taking that has to be restored. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and facilitate you doing your own visioning about what this looks like for you and your faith communities. With that said, we have a few more minutes that we had wanted to dedicate to some Q&A, so feel free to fire away.
Oh, and one little note, we end at 5 every day. It will not be 2 hours.
Yes.
Are you looking for cohorts outside of the Seattle area?
We don't explicitly go out of our way, just because we want to be able to meet in person with people, and we also want to have sort of the community connections to provide to folks. If you were doing discernment in another state, for example, and we had no ties to that state, we might not know what kind of community groups that you need to be in conversation with, and not be able to support you that way. Probably we could help you find folks to talk to in your own area. But right now, we don't do a lot of recruiting for congregations out of state.
Well, regional, what sort of?
King County.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I saw a hand earlier. Is it?
It was clarified.
Okay.
Thank you.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Any other questions folks have? We know that was a lot of information, which is why we built it this time.
I have one about the spiral. Could you go back to that slide?
Sure.
Yes.
Yes.
They look like footprints to me.
They are.
So you start in the middle?
Yes.
And go out?
Yes.
Okay.
Beautiful. Wow.
So you end up learning?
No. No. So this is a little bit of our graphic design. Go ahead.
Imagine you are here, right? You are at Listen. This is the very first step that you're taking is at Listen. And then you're going to do a little bit of learning, right? Which is kind of happening right now. And then you're going to walk yourself to act. The reason why it spirals outward is because until you've done the internal work, which is something that we know from working at the church council, what it takes to like shift internally in an organization, until you've done that, you're not going to be able to really show up properly in community, right? It's sort of a clean your own house before inviting guests over situation.
Okay, so you keep doing the spiral is that you...
Yes.
Do the learning and the acting and the reflecting and the listening and learn more and act again and reflect and listen.
Yes.
Okay. And all the while, right, you're covering more and more ground.
Okay.
I think sometimes people have this tendency to look at the scale of the problem and it's so big and so audacious that they're like, we have to jump all the way to the end, right? We're going to abolish ICE tomorrow. Yeah. But there's all of these things, right, that have to happen in order for that to happen. And some of those things are things that we can do. That's right in front of us. I call this cleaning up the garbage that's closest to you. There's a lot of garbage that has to be cleaned up. Why are you taking a flight to another place to clean up their garbage when you've got plenty right here in your local community?
I guess for me, for this picture, if the footprints came off the act and kept going around, I would have...
That's a good piece of feedback. We could definitely make this
visual
more accessible. That's a true thing. We're going to take that back to our communications person.
We did not design this.
Yeah, because I didn't even think it was feet. I thought it was ants, so I thought it started at the end on the outside. So I was like, learn was supposed to be first, yeah.
That would be very
satisfying. Your goal was only the learning, yes.
But it keeps going. It doesn't end at that last step.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Back on the two charts that you had for transforming values.
Yes.
Down in very small print at the bottom, is this focused on mission with a bias toward effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
and the other one had a bias toward efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I'd like to know at a practical level,
mm-hmm.
what you see as some of the differences, because I know I probably personally lean, so let's just move on, because it seems like we stay in a very tiny spiral around listening, you know, and don't move on in some. So what does efficiency look like, and what does effectiveness look like?
Sure, yes. And I resonate, because I think I'm also working on this, but I think I'm also you naturally. When it comes to a preference for efficiency over effectiveness sometimes, what we've found, and kind of once again grounding this in the discernment work that we're doing with faith communities, is that the tendency to want to just push, let's just get to the next thing, let's check something else off the checklist. By the end of the process, usually there's a whole group of people, let's pretend that you're in the listen phase, for example, trying to just get opinions from folks of what exactly they'd like to see, knowing that something needs to be done with the worship space, as an example. There will be a process of, okay, we have to check off all these different names, we have to get this done in sort of an arbitrary time frame, for example. And then at the end of it, results will be presented from those conversations to the whole congregation, and inevitably, a sizable chunk of the congregation will say, well, no one ever reached out to me. I don't agree with these results.
Right.
How did you come to them? Who had these conversations? Now people are feeling personally slighted because the original sort of group that was holding the work or the process chose to be efficient over effective, even though it would have taken longer to have been effective. Effectiveness in this example would have looked like, okay, we really do need to talk. We know the people in our congregation. We know the sort of nature of our congregation. We know that we need to talk to everyone, or there will inevitably be this group of people that says, you don't like me personally because you didn't talk to me about this process that we're doing, even though you know that that's not true. And so even though 3 months may feel like the better thing, it may look better, it may sound better to people, or maybe even from a planning perspective, thinking about the rhythms of the year, it may make more sense from that perspective. It is better to extend it to an entire year of listening than to try to get to all of those people and have all of those meaningful conversations, build all of those relationships, and then after that year present the information and everyone is already agreeing with it because they feel included, than to have done that 3 months in a rushed fashion, done the same thing, and then have to basically do it over again because you left people out, and also you have to tend to the harm, you know, unintended, that happened in that process. So that's a specific example, but that's sort of what it looks like in this process.
I think the example that comes to mind is, again, that one with the apartment building. That's an efficient use of space to have a bunch more units, but they're single bedroom units, but is it an effective use of space?
Does that answer your question?
I feel like that sort of relates in a way to the challenge of measurable outcomes. That in a white institutional, in my experience, in white institutional settings, that getting money from the budget or whatever depends on measurable outcomes. And you can't always measure a change in the way of being.
Right.
And so when you're on the next chart, I feel like that the transformative, how do you measure transformation, you know? So I'm just thinking about those two words, efficiency and effectiveness, and how there has to be a buy-in to the reality that, and maybe the discomfort for white institutions, especially that we may not have a spreadsheet on this at the end, but we may be able to see a difference in the way we are as a people.
That's a great reflection, and that's something that comes up a lot as a question in the early days from many of our congregations. An example of this is one of the congregations that I'm accompanying that's based in South King County is a small church with a lot of history, and I feel like that is a separate session. to this kind of point, they were almost closed. They're a Methodist, and I say that only to say that the polity would have allowed district superintendent to recommend that they be closed because from a budget perspective, they were in the hole, and from a purely measurable outcomes, like how many people are in the seats kind of thing,
they were like, well, this church isn't successful based on these, you know, these measures that have been made outside of, they're kind of been decontextualized, honestly. Right. Mm-hmm. And so literally the district superintendent came in to have a meeting with the pastor a few years ago, actually a couple of years ago, I've been a few, almost 2 years ago, to say, look, we're going to put the padlock on the door. Y'all need to kind of figure out what you're going to do, after them having been there for at least three generations. In this particular community. And when he actually arrived to service, to kind of like, it was sort of almost a goodbye service from his perspective in leadership, he was surprised to see the level of community programs that were going on, the level of buy-in from the local community, which this is in a small, highly, I don't want to say segregated necessarily, but politically divided, that sometimes, not always, is a long race community. So it's not a community that already comes together easily. I think that's what I'm trying to paint the picture of. But yet in this congregation, there was a mix of folks from different racial backgrounds doing all kinds of community programs that impacted, yes, the direct members of that church, but also the surrounding area. And that was not what he expected to see. He also didn't expect to see the sort of organic nature of these programs. So it wasn't the sort of copy and paste, every church does this kind of program type of things that we probably all can think about, but it was coming directly from the needs of the community. So an example is that after doing some listening to different folks who were coming in and out of the emergency homeless shelter that the church had provided on behalf of the county, actually, for several years, they realized there was a severe mental health need in their community. And so with the limited resources, remember, this is a church that has a budget over $10,000 in the hole at this point. They, and not without a plan to figure out how to fill that hole, they said, you know, we have to respond to this. People are not well. And so they created a community garden program because they heard people say that gardening was therapeutic. And they were like, well, we have the space to do that, and we can do it easily. We have some natural gardeners who kind of already put around a little bit. Let's just develop part of the land that we're on for that purpose. And sure enough, not just people from that small faith community, but other folks from the larger community came to, and still do to this day, garden at this congregation. Now, will all those people end up at Sunday service? Not all of them. Especially some of this happened during the pandemic, so it's a whole different kind of conversation about that. But the point is, the district superintendent got sort of the lay of the land, if you will, within the specific context, and said, we can't close this church down because they're actually doing church work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're actually making a difference in the community, and though it's small, it is actually small but mighty. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're actually in a process now, kind of to wrap up this thought, of trying to figure out, you know, what does it look for us from a long-term perspective to be financially viable, to potentially continue to maybe redevelop, but maybe just reutilize the space that they currently have in ways that makes it an even broader, almost like community hub, in which there is a worship component, but it's not exclusively a congregation.
I want to uplift a cool part of that, the question of, like, how do you measure transformation? Because that's part of the reflection process, right? Mm-hmm. And how other people measure it doesn't have to be the way that we measure it. So you can have a whole discernment process oriented around, how do we actually measure the transformation that happens? Before this, I used to work in, like, a disability service system, sort of, we're trying to adapt and make it more culturally responsive. And one of the units of measurement for a particular individual to determine if their service plan was working for them was how many times they smiled in a day. Mm-hmm. They didn't communicate in traditional ways that people would, but they had managed to communicate that when they're smiling, that's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, what does that look like in a congregational context? Like, how many programs are happening, how many people are being reached doesn't always tell the whole story. So it's about developing a model of evaluation that works for you, that shows here's our intention, and here's our reality, and here's how long we're moving from our intention to our reality.
We can all play it. They just need to go.
You're not in the community.
No, I'm not. Sorry. It's really, really concerning. I'm imagining this having still happen here very often.
Oh, yeah. It's a siren.
Right.
It could be healthcare.
It could be
a spider in his child.
Oh, no.
Had that yesterday.
Yeah. So you heard us in our chalet.
It's a spider in your cabin.
It's a spider in your cabin.
Some of those spiders are big boys, though.
They're nothing to be played with. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're about to wrap up our time here together, just in general. If there's any other questions.
We've got about 3 minutes.
So for anybody's information, right up there is Gertrude, and it has the panel that has all the buildings. So is there somebody standing in the hall right here toward the doors?
Closet to the right.
Unless they moved it. And then...
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're announcing where the issue is.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will go to the host houses. Some people will go to the location. And we just need to stay out of their way.
I was going to go back to something with the competitive view.
Oh,
what's
competitive individualism?
Right, and that's kind of a personality thing as well. How does the how do you deal with that? Not just that, but just the personality thing. There must be a lot of. Is there an assessment of that, or what's you know? Because I would think that, and I'm the kind of person that has that kind of thing, and that I don't show up. You know, I like that part, and not showing up part. You know, but you know, I really. What? How do you work through those and make sure that you have a group that's gonna not push you in that direction, because you can't, unless you deal with that kind of up front, you're toast.
There's a few different ways, I feel like. Sometimes, honestly, we're successful, sometimes we're not. So I just want to be transparent about that. Sometimes people have very dominant personalities, and us, especially because we're not in the congregation, right? We don't go to church with these people every Sunday. So I can think of one example. It became clear, I was accompanying a congregation, this was in our first cohort, it became clear very quickly, probably within 1 to 2 of our sort of breakout meetings where we just meet with those folks, not the entire cohort from each faith community, that there were a couple of superstars or divas, is what I'll call them, and you kind of have to be prepared for the divas, right? Because people, once again, they'll put on a certain face because they want to be in the cohort for whatever reason, right? They say maybe one reason, they might meet another, but that's a whole other thing. But then you'll sort of see kind of like who are those, and sometimes they're natural leaders, sometimes they're not necessarily leaders, but they are very persuasive. Like, they have some of the characteristics of leaders, but they use them in manipulative ways. So then, honestly, what we do as a team is we do a lot of planning around those specific individuals. Because the way that they show up in that smaller team dynamic, and therefore what they're going to bring back and probably already have been inflicting upon the congregation, is also what they're bringing to the cohort space, which is a space where people are supposed to be learning and processing, like, pretty, like, major stuff together and being very vulnerable in that process. So some of what it can look like to try to, I don't want to say necessarily contain, but what it can look like to kind of, like, redirect some of that energy, especially once we've gone through the values training, because that isn't, like, the very first day kind of thing. Y'all are getting, like, the rough and ready version today. We'll talk about, okay, so-and-so, how do we think they're going to show up in this next meeting based on this previous experience we've had of them, or based maybe on even things that other people in their congregational team have said of them in separate one-to-one meetings, which is why it's important to do your one-to-ones as an organizer. And so from there, we'll develop a plan sort of like on a case-by-case basis to say, okay, well, they have strengths in this thing, right? Maybe they're very good at research, and you know if you send them on a task to do research, like, they will do the best research the world has ever seen. And then everyone else can kind of, you know, clue into that, and their team can clue into that and be like, wow, we're learning so much together, right? So they still have an accountability kind of system built in. And yet, you know, they're still able to be an individual with skills, but not necessarily at the expense of everyone else.
Right.
But this also doesn't always work.
Right. Yeah.
I don't want to presume that I know, like, the details of your situation, but I think, like, we're also talking about something larger here. Like, when we're talking about competitive individualism, if we're talking about a rivalry, like, my advice is just don't play, right? Like, let them have their rivalry, but if you are in a structure that enables it, then your work is about addressing the structure.
Yeah.
If someone's being rewarded for being competitive or, you know, like, behaving and showing up in that way, then the structure has to be changed before we can really talk to that person about their behavior, right? Because then we're not just asking them to make a change for the health of a group. We're asking them to, you know, give up other things when they're empowered by an imbalanced dynamic. I think also, like, at a certain point, we recognize that we only have so much capacity to do that sort of navigating that you was talking about. And there are times where we just have to draw a boundary and be like, we're not going to do it. Our capacity is better directed elsewhere, you know, best of luck to you, but, like, we're going to focus our energy on this.
Right.
And when we're talking about, like, competitive individualism, we have to also acknowledge, like, are we showing up in the other half of that relationship as well? Is there something we can do to move away from that in order to not play? Is that helpful at all to you?
Yeah, to me it's, I was one of the first jobs, major jobs I got, one of the principals said, you know, nobody has any faults, they just overuse their strengths, you know, and it's that type of thing that you have to, you know, do have faults, but...
Some of us don't.
That's right, my daughter here, this is my daughter, so she doesn't have many. You don't tell that to the women you're with, by the way, I'm just going to say that. I'm an odd man out here, so anyways, it's that type of thing, right? You know, and we worked in church groups where it's like, wow, you know, hold it, we're not even started yet. Like you said, the learning and the reflecting, and it's like, why are we jumping to all this? You know, we can't do that because we're really not sure where we're at yet. And it's you know, to bring that person back, it's a very important, so you don't waste a lot of time.
I think it kind of harks back to Ace's presentation this morning too. Like, what does it mean to be the most powerful? What does it mean to be the best?
Yeah.
Like, being humble, and part of that, like, work of decolonizing is being able to disrupt that idea that because you can do something the most or the longest or, you know, in any one particular fashion means that you're doing it the best. Sometimes there are another way of being would have allowed other people to be stronger, and that synergy gets built, and collectively something more powerful has happened, or something, you know, greater has occurred. And so you being the person and of the party that's, like, doing the most of that thing isn't actually bringing the group as far along as it would be if you did a little bit less and stepped back. But those are things that really have to happen when people have close personal relationships with that person, so that person has a vested interest in hearing someone out and, you know, like, taking a look at themselves and being like, oh, this is actually going to help me in my relationships with people that I care about.
All right. We are at 5:06. So I think that's our time. Thank you all for coming out.